Been moving all around the Taipei area.
Oh, this always feels good.
It's 5:30 in the afternoon here in Kathmandu, Nepal.
Okay, just a few hundred steps to go, and I'm at the top of the platform here of Swayamvunath, the monkey temple.
I was drinking a mixture of beer, a rice wine, and I am really feeling it now.
I am up at 3:30 in the morning. Go to a tuna auction.
I am here in Mumbai, India.
And I'm here in Tokyo, Japan for Sakura, the cherry blossoms.
It's 7:45 in the morning here in Phnom Penh, and I'm just going to try to cross the street. I'm going to try on a crosswalk.
It's 6:15 in the morning, and I think I'm one of the only people in Ta Prohm. This is the Tomb Raider Temple.
Hi, I'm John Sabo, and this is the Far East Travels Podcast.
Hey there, welcome to the Far East Travels Podcast. This is John Sabo coming to you from Central Vietnam in Da Nang, and very excited in this episode to be speaking with Dave Greco. Dave in Osaka. We've had him on the show before. I think the last time we had him on, he was calling in from Greenland. Dave's always an interesting guy to chat with. He's an English professor. He's a Canadian expat living in Japan for 20 years. He's a YouTuber, live streamer. And we're going to get some thoughts and experiences of Dave's travels in the last year within, of course, Japan, because, of course, nobody can really travel abroad or hasn't been able to. So we'll speak to Dave. Very excited about that in this episode. So we've had a little bit of rain here through the evening and through the day here, in the morning at least, in Da Nang. Certainly sets the mood for a different feel. And mood has been kind of changing. I mean, this week, fortunately, we had some of the restrictions lifted on the current lockdown that was happening here, or what I'd call like a soft lockdown. So this week, the beach opened up in Da Nang again, which was great. They opened up restaurants again and cafes for dining in. I believe they're supposed to close at 9. So that's some positive signs. On sort of the melancholy signs, there's been a lot of foreigners that have had to exit Vietnam because of new rules with visas. And, you know, maybe not in this episode, but in a future episode, I'll talk a little bit more about that. So lots of stuff going on here. But the good news is, at least in Da Nang, they've gotten a hold on this latest outbreak here of the pandemic. So thank you again for your support, whether you're making donations or you're pledging on Patreon. It's always really appreciated. And those links, again, will always be in the show notes of this episode of the podcast. So you can check that out if you want to support the Far East Travels podcast. And if you want to help others discover the Far East Travels podcast, really easy to do. Just follow the link that goes to Apple Podcasts or iTunes. That'll be in the show notes. And then make sure you're signed into your account. Rate the podcast out of 5 stars. Write a review, and you'll help others discover the Far East Travels podcast. So it's always a pleasure to have Dave in Osaka on, as he's widely known throughout the social media world. Dave is a prolific tweeter, live streamer. You can also catch him on YouTube. He's an English professor, very interesting guy, well-traveled, and really, again, a pleasure to have Dave on this episode of the podcast. So I want to kind of give the audience some context, because I contacted you a few days ago. You were on my latest YouTube video. You shared how the whole emergency declaration, you've been going through in Osaka, you know, how you've been dealing with that. And then I said to you, well, let's do a podcast episode as well. And you said, sure, just let me know. And then I contacted you today and you said, yeah, and you gave me some times. And then And you said Friday was okay. So I asked you if Friday today would be okay. And you said, yeah. And then you contacted me just a little while ago saying that I've been outside. I'm really enjoying, you know, my time here. Can I do this without a studio setup? And I said, of course. So tell me where you are right now in Kyoto.
I'm just right in the middle of the city between Shijo Street and Sanjo Street, which is two of the main streets downtown. And I'm inside. I'm behind the main streets, actually walking in the neighborhood. There's a lot of shops and there's a lot of people walking around. I'm in a local park right now, and there's quite a few people out. Everybody's masked up, but there's a lot of people outside enjoying this perfect weather.
And just tell me how you're feeling today, because I mean, you've been kind of cooped up a lot lately. I know you're teaching from home now, and you know there's nothing open after 8 o'clock in Osaka. Like, how do you feel today, like getting out there and enjoying, you know, the weather and Kyoto?
I it's a beautiful day. We haven't been in since April 24th was the first day of the first announcement, the first emergency declaration. So it's going to be 2 months on the 24th. So I do appreciate the time when I can get out and when I do get out. Especially now it's getting into the end of the rainy season. It started a bit earlier this year. So, the nights are really nice and cool. And I think everybody's gotten kind of sick of it. It's going to be 2 months now that we've been on this emergency declaration. Infections are much lower. Vaccines are ramping up. So I think there's a bit more positive atmosphere and, people are getting out a little bit more.
Well, that's great. And I'm sure these days Kyoto must be a much different experience than it is, you know, when things are open up to international travelers, because I mean, the town, the city gets about 35, 40 million visitors a year. So, yeah. So what is Kyoto like, or what has it been lately? And you've lived in Japan now for over 20 years, right?
Yeah. It's been 20 years this year. Yeah. It's never been, I can't remember when it's been like this. Maybe when I first came here in the winter time, that's always the lower season. When I first arrived in Japan in 2001, it was kind of this quiet, but, to be now during some of the peak times, well, any time is peak now, before the pandemic because of the mass tourism. But, now it's still the emergency declaration. So there's a lot of shops still closed during the day. There are fewer people out, even though things are, like I said, turning around. Extremely quiet. You don't have the tourists rolling their luggage down the street. Gion, which is, a popular spot, there's hardly anybody walking down the street. They're getting a lot of construction done because there is fewer people walking around. It's just a very, very quiet city, and I miss that. So.
And you're kind of an avid live streamer. I mean, I love your live streams, the stuff that you've shared over the years, and I know you're totally big on sharing Japanese culture and makos and geikos or geishas. Would you even be able to spot one these days? Would they be out walking around, even masked up?
No, I believe that they're still closed. They're not working right now. Maybe things are, I don't know about, within the scene, probably things behind the scene are going on, with regular customers. They still do have the debuts, like the younger Maikos, the geisha houses are still debuting them. So there are still girls working and new ones coming in. I think there's a lot more of them retiring, though. That's one of the disappointing things that's happened. But you don't really see them walking on the street. I did see one. It was last year, or was it earlier this year in the winter? A couple of them were walking around on Hanami Kojidori, which is the main street. She had her GoPro, her and her friend. They were all, it was the most famous or the most financially successful geisha of all time. Satsuki. It was her and a Maiko walking down the street with their GoPro, which they could never do any other time of year. So that's the situation, just to give you an idea of how few people are around.
Wow. And there's something else interesting I just found out recently. I was doing some research, and there's a very famous bag shop in Kyoto. Like, they make canvas bags.
Okay.
And up until the pandemic, you could never buy one online. They did not have a website that you could buy online from. The only way you could buy one of these bags was to visit the store in Kyoto. That was the Yeah, that was the only way you could buy a bag. And then somebody brought it to my attention a few months ago that now they are selling online, which is, you know, for the tradition of Kyoto, I guess some people don't realize how traditional Kyoto is in many ways. That is just, you know, remarkable for them to change from, you know, their style of business to actually selling online. There are still shops in Kyoto that you cannot purchase anything from unless you have a personal referral first. So I don't think people really realize how traditional Kyoto is in many ways. So I guess, you know, some businesses have just had to adapt to this. I mean, not all of those 35 million visitors are international tourists. I mean, a lot of Japanese visit Kyoto every year.
Yes.
But Dave, I mean, you there must be, you know, I mean, the feeling or atmosphere you could probably convey to us, you know, must be just so incredibly dramatically different than it normally is.
Absolutely. You know, there was a lot of tension, I think, with a lot of people in Kyoto because there were so many tourists. And, you know, there was all there was in the news was, how are we going to deal with it? How are we dealing with this? How are we going to turn this around? There's too many people here. It was just nonstop about that. And not only that, but actually being here and seeing it, too, it was a pretty stressful situation. And now to see the complete opposite, and it's kind of a relief in a way. I know there's a lot of people obviously suffering financially, but just to have a little bit of breathing room there and maybe some more time to think of what's going to happen when this is all done and how to deal with it, it's been kind of a, you know, a bit of a relief there. But I have to say, too, that I think it's good that it's good that the locals can appreciate it more. I think a lot more people domestically are coming here. The ones, you know, having all the tourists come in, I think that scared a lot of locals off, or even people, Japanese people thinking of traveling here, just scared them off. So I think it's a time for the country, and, you know, most countries around the world, to maybe appreciate where they are and what you know, what beauty we have within our country. I know that is just a silver lining to a pretty grim situation.
Yeah, and that kind of leads us into, you know, what I wanted to also talk to you about today, because, I mean, you're an avid traveler. You're a world traveler. I mean, you've spoken to me before from Greenland. I mean, from Thailand. I mean, all these different places. And I mean, I because you are an English professor, I mean, because of your schedule, it allows you to travel for extended periods of time. How has it been for you personally? Because, I mean, you travel to Southeast Asia pretty much every year and sometimes for weeks at a time. How has it been for you missing that?
Well, you know, I was thinking about how the psychological impact, and, you know, before I have quite long holidays because of the nature of my job, and I would get very restless, and I would want to travel and make the most of my time, whether it be go back to Canada or travel to Southeast Asia or somewhere else. But I think because of this pandemic and having to stay home even while I'm working, it's kind of made me slow down the pace and just appreciate where I am. And it's made me realize how exhausting and how much energy I did use before. You know, going to Canada and coming back here, that's 2 weeks of jet lag. And if you do go back to Canada two times a year, that's like a month a year, basically, where you're jet lagged. And that's, you know, it takes its toll, I think. And as you're getting older, it takes its toll even more. And, you know, that's one of the things I feel, is that I really slowed the pace down. And I've just been able to appreciate where I am, and maybe I have a lot more energy to deal with you know, day-to-day things.
Well, that's really interesting, and you know, because I follow you as well in your travels. You know, you've obviously, you know, stayed in Japan this past year or over a year. What? Where are some of the places you go? I mean, I know you went to Tohoku region, and this was the epicenter of the 2011 earthquake and tsunami. What made you want to go there?
Another thing about this mass tourism is when it comes time for my holiday, I usually just leave Japan. I don't want to be here when I have free time. I usually just go visit my family. But this was a perfect time to go and see the rest of the country, even places like Tokyo, which is just flooded with tourists. So I decided to go up there, which was a bit quieter, and during the winter too. So it would even be quieter than in the summertime. So that's basically why I went up there.
And, you know, what were some of the highlights? I mean, I've seen just images on, you know, NHK and some of the stories, the suffering that people went through, you know, during this disaster was just incredible. I mean, losing their homes, losing their, you know, families. I saw a story about a woman that, you know, she had a fishing boat business with her husband, and, you know, they lost their boats, and then they decided to, you know, restart the business. And then I think a year or two later, she lost her husband in a disaster out at sea and with, I think, her daughter, who was along as well. So, I mean, this woman was pretty much left alone. And this was even after, a couple of years after the event. So, I mean, I've seen all of these really heartbreaking stories. Yeah. What did you come away with visiting this area of Japan?
You know, it's there. Unfortunately, I think that they're still rebuilding. I mean, just what you can see, they are still, I mean, maybe just finishing cleaning up and clearing things out and flattening out the land to do something with it. That's where they're at right now. And just to think, like, they're still, I think they're still going over the psychological impact of it and having to see that every day, that their town was destroyed. And economically, there's nothing there. If you go to two of the towns, one of them was called Rikuzen Takata, and the other one's Minami Sanriku. They were completely flattened, and you know, in an area where was normally densely populated, it's completely cleared out. There's nothing there still. All they've done is they've flattened the land, and they've actually tried to raise it 10 meters to prepare for the next tsunami, so there'll be less damage, and they have a 10 meter advantage for when it's going to come. They've built breakwaters off the shore to stop it. And you know, they're still rebuilding. There's no houses still, very few, and Rikuzen Takata actually relocated the center of their city farther inland, and it's completely new, and there's very little there, but they do have somewhat of a city center. And Minami Sanriku is another one that was severely damaged. The center of the city is just these makeshift stores made of plywood. You know, there's a convenience store and some restaurants, a grocery store, and they're very much still rebuilding. There's not much there still.
And you also went to Fukushima as well.
Yeah, I was in. I went inland. I didn't go to the shore where the reactor was, but I went to a place called Oichijuku, which was an old post town between Tokyo and a north city of Japan. I can't recall what it was, but it was one of the old post towns there. So I went and visited their beautiful little post town. They still kind of preserved it to make it look kind of authentic, but it was really nice.
And it was, you know, fairly safe to visit?
Yeah, I was looking up, and you know, I guess some of the people I know that have looked into that information, there's dosimeters, I guess they're called, that measure the radiation. Some of the things are kind of iffy, I guess. In if you look up the city on their website, they have the dosimeter readings, and I don't know how many dosimeters there are, but you know, the nature of radiation is, you just move 50 meters another way, that area could be radiated, and the dosimeter might not pick it up. That's one thing someone was telling me. So it is kind of a, you know, I don't know, up in the air situation. I guess they're even saying too, with the torch relay for the Olympics, outside of the stadium, they found a hot spot, and they had to clean it up before they actually went along and continued with the event. But that's the kind of, that's the nature of radiation, right? No matter how many dosimeters you have, you just move, you know, 100 meters or 50 meters another way, that could be a hot spot. You don't even know it.
Well, somebody actually had created this. I remember seeing it was, I think it was a Netflix episode or a Netflix series of this journalist that went traveling to all these kind of dangerous, off the beaten path tourist places. And they had actually created this tour of this area, and they actually had a meter to measure it, and the people were getting scared on the bus as they were driving through because the meter kept climbing and climbing, and then the driver, I guess, asked if they wanted to still keep going or if they wanted to leave, and I think everybody pretty much wanted to leave. But beyond that, there's also, I mean, lots of beautiful things to see there. It's a very famous part of Japan for its volcanoes, and did you have a chance to see any of those famous mountains or volcanoes while you were there?
The only mountain I went up was Mount Haguro, which is in Yamagata Prefecture near a city called Tsuruoka. It's one of the three great mountains called Dewa Sanzan, three sacred mountains. And that was the only one that I went to. Winter is kind of a hard place to travel up there because the snow is so deep. Like, it's several meters deep. So getting around is very difficult. The bus schedule is not as frequent, and because of the pandemic, even less frequent. There's less frequent buses, so it's not an easy place to travel in the winter. And one of the only mountains that is open that you can climb is this Mount Haguro. So I did go up there, and it was really beautiful. Yeah, a beautiful view of that whole area. It's the lowest one too. It's only 400 meters. I mean, that's it, but It was still just in the wintertime. It's very, very beautiful.
And it's a very famous Shinto pilgrimage site for Japanese as well, I understand.
Yeah, I think it's since the 6th century, it's been a pilgrimage site. People have done all the three mountains. It's something you do. You climb each of the three mountains, and it's you complete the pilgrimage up there.
Okay, you also went to a very famous onsen. And, I mean, some people call this the most beautiful onsen in Japan, Suro no Yu.
Tsuruno-yu, yes, right.
How was that?
It was amazing. Another place way in the mountains. There's a lake, Tazawa. From there, it took about, I believe it was 1 or 2 hour bus ride. And then I missed another bus. I had to take a taxi. Actually, there was a taxi. And
that must have been expensive.
I actually shared it with two other people. We were all stuck there. So we called a taxi and went to this onsen, and yeah, I think it's a 400 year old onsen. I mean, it wasn't built as an onsen then; it was just a natural spring, and it's, I guess people say it hasn't changed much since about maybe the early 1900s. It kind of has that feel, early 1900s Japan. It definitely does, and you can stay in the rooms. It has the old kind of cooking area within the floor with the sand, you know, and you just cook within the room. It's like a milky white sulfur bath, and just a beautiful spot in the mountains. It was actually quite busy, even though it was during the pandemic, and there was a lot of older people from Tokyo, so it was kind of funny. Most of the people we talked to, they're like, "Oh yeah, we're from Yokohama, from Tokyo," so they were going all up there, enjoying the lack of tourists, and that's why they went up, because there's no tourists to kind of flood the place. But it's just a beautiful, beautiful area.
Well, I've personally never stayed in a ryokan in Japan, but I mean, I hear about all these incredible experiences that people have. I mean, you go to these beautiful resorts, and it's traditional. They have the, you know, tatami mats, and you sleep on the futon on the floor, and just go sit in the hot springs and eat. And I mean, it sounds amazing. You know, how would you rate that experience, maybe another, you know, ryokan experience that you've had?
I didn't stay overnight. I only did the day experience.
Okay.
But I would say that was definitely the best. Absolutely. I've been to several onsen, a day onsen, and even overnight ones. That was by far the best. And I did see the rooms. I asked to see them, and they were just, I mean, they weren't luxurious. They definitely preserved the way it was 100 years ago. But just to experience the whole thing, the way life was back then, it was amazing.
Now, if you're a foreigner and, you know, you don't speak Japanese, can you maneuver around this area, this region? I mean, would you be able to, you know, using your English skills, be able to, you know, arrange to get the bus ride and get to these types of places?
It's hard for me to say because I didn't, you know, I'm not in that situation. But I would say in some, in that situation, maybe I didn't see any English. I don't recall, but maybe some of the signs inside of the onsen, yes, there were. But I think if if you're staying in Akita City, or if you're in the Lake Tazawa area, wherever you're staying, we'll be able to help you get there for sure.
Do you find some of the staff can speak a little bit of English? Are they used to, you know, foreign tourists that are English speaking?
No one there spoke any English, definitely. They were all only Japanese speakers for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, and we should also, of course, because you've lived in Japan for 20 years, share with everybody that if we haven't already, that you know, you're pretty fluent in Japanese.
Yeah. I can get by pretty good. Yeah.
Now, I mean, among other things that you've done this last year, I mean, you've obviously, you know, done the whole cherry blossom thing. I mean, do you do that every year, Dave? Do you go and see the cherry blossoms every year?
I try and stay away from the crowds of people. Again, because of the mass tourism, I don't go to the popular areas, any place in Kyoto or, in Tokyo, absolutely not. I won't go anywhere near Tokyo. But I did this year, so I figured if there's any time I was going to do it, it was going to be now. If I do go somewhere, it'll be out in the rural areas. I was in Mount Yoshino. That's a popular spot. There weren't many tourists there. I didn't see many foreign people. I didn't hear, a lot of foreign languages. So places like that, I think people stick to the usual routes a lot.
And you were in Tokyo this year for the tail end of the cherry blossom season. How was that?
It was very busy. I can't even imagine. I've never been there during a normal year, so I can't even imagine what it was like considering how busy it was this year. I went to Shinjuku Gyoen, which is, you know, like the central park of Tokyo. And even there, you had to reserve a time to go in, and, you know, you had a ticket. And even then, the park was very busy. I can't imagine in regular times where people are just freely allowed to go in. You do have to pay an admission, but I can't imagine how it would be like. Even this year, I felt it was kind of a bit overcrowded.
Well, I've only ever been once, and I was there on the first weekend that the blossoms kind of fully bloomed.
Okay.
And I got totally burned on my hotel because I was just booking as I was going along, and I waited too late to book my Saturday night, Dave. And okay. I ended up having to pay like $300 just for an average room because everybody had just migrated into Tokyo. I mean, that's what happens. You know, the locals just go crazy over this stuff. So they had all flooded in. But I mean, I'd been to Ueno Park and, you know, up in near the palace grounds, you know, a couple of the most popular places to see the cherry blossoms. And it was busy, but it wasn't like I didn't find it overwhelming. My expectations were like, well, you know, this is Tokyo, the biggest city in the world. You got to expect there's going to be a few people here. Right.
Right. Exactly.
But I mean, it was to me, I just walked away with it. You know, even with the crowds, I thought it was a wonderful experience. So I can't even imagine what it would have been like for you. Well, I mean, guess not knowing what it's like normally, you wouldn't have that as a reference. But
no,
still,
I didn't.
I'm sure it was very enjoyable for you.
What year was that you were there?
2015.
Oh, okay. All right. Not too long ago. It was absolutely beautiful. I'd never been there before. So the Shinjuku Gyoen is just amazing. What a beautiful park. And Chidori Gafuchi, the one near the Imperial Palace, that's one of the places you mentioned. That's just amazing. Watching the people and the little boats there and the sakura lining the the riverside's just, it is really beautiful. It's worth it to deal, even dealing with the crowds. It's definitely something you can't miss.
Oh, and just to take that walk around the whole palace, and you can see the Budokan from there. And I mean, I pictured the Beatles playing there. And I mean, you know, Cheap Trick. I mean, all those great bands, right? And, you know, so it's just a wonderful place to walk as well. And you know, people jog there every day. I love it. But I wanted to sort of get off to the Olympics because they still are going ahead with the Summer Olympics, the 2020 Olympics this year in Tokyo. And I wanted to get your feelings on it and maybe, you know, share with us, you know, how you feel, because, what we're seeing is that, you know, most of the population of Japan feels that it's just not the right thing to do, but it's going ahead anyways. Like, how do you feel about it? And how does, you know, your circle of friends and acquaintances feel about the Olympics going ahead this year?
Yeah, I don't know anyone who is saying, let's do it. This is going to be great. I'm looking forward to it. I'm definitely hearing people saying, no, this shouldn't go on. And even if you don't, look at those people saying no, I can't see anyone saying, let's do it. I don't see anyone positively saying, oh, we're going to enjoy this. It's going to be a great time. Other than the government and the IOC, those are the only two people saying that this should go on and it's going to be good. So that's definitely the mood. Here. And my attitude is, I don't think it should go on. Even if the vaccines are ramping up, I think as of today, we have 12% of the population has had one shot at least. And it goes up quickly every day, every few days. I don't think that it's a time to do that, especially in a country that just recently have showed that they haven't got it under control. I think it's just so contradictory. Osaka was one of the hot spots in the news just a few weeks ago. We had over 100% of our beds were full of the severely ill. So I don't see how you feel that you can hold an Olympics. One of the Olympic officials, she even made a very good point, and I feel the same, is that they did not acknowledge the public opinion at all. If anything, they doubled down on it and said, even in an emergency declaration, we will hold the Olympics. It was never like, we understand how you feel, but we're going to do this. It was like, we are going to do it. It's going on. So I felt that it totally disregarded what the public felt. I don't feel like they ever acknowledged it. And, you know, that if anything, that makes people more against it and more against not wanting to do this. It's like us against them kind of feeling. And that's not, you know, that's not going to make us build any more spirit than, you know, we already don't have any feeling to celebrate this event. It's not going to make it any better to have that kind of attitude.
Well, are people feeling that the IOC is really behind this, that they're really putting pressure on, Japan to host these Olympics?
Absolutely. And at the same time, I think it's showing how weak that the Japanese government is, that they don't step up and do something and say, we can't do this. Especially the prime minister, he seems like a very, very weak person. He's coming off as very weak, the way he doesn't stand up to that at all. The one thing he said was, the IOC has decided that the Olympics are going on. Like, they have no say at all. Like, Japan has no say at all. The IOC has decided the Olympics are going on. That's terrible. Wow.
So, and I mean, Japan has, a tremendous record for being a great host, during the Olympics. You visited Nagano, which was the host site of the 98 Winter Olympics. Was that the first time you visited this past year?
Yeah, I've never been to Nagano. It was, it was the first time I've been to Nagano, yeah.
And how was it? What did you take away from Nagano?
It was a beautiful spot. I know that in the Olympics, I mean, it was the whole prefecture that hosted it. I know there were areas outside of Nagano, not only Nagano City, but I think it was the whole prefecture. So it was kind of spread out everywhere. But, I'm stuck in the city most of the time in Osaka, or I'll visit, even Kyoto is, fairly urban. to go out there and to see the nature, that's, it's such a beautiful spot and so great to see that part of Japan. You know, especially, I think a lot of people have that image of Japan as a very urban place, very densely populated. And even I feel like that, you know, being here 20 years, most of that time I've spent in the city, to get out there and to see that, it's you know, really kind of eye-opening even for me, even though I've been living here for so long. So beautiful spot, definitely a beautiful spot, Nagano.
Well, I think if people are going to go to Japan, they've never been before, I mean, you obviously want to see Tokyo, and you know, you wouldn't want to miss Kyoto. You know, in your opinion, you know, having lived there for 20 years and you know, done a fair amount of extensive travel and, you know, throughout the country and you know, an incredible understanding of the people and the culture and everything, you know, tell us two or three places that you would say off of, you know, Tokyo or Kyoto that people should visit when they come to Japan.
I would say that definitely Tohoku, like you mentioned before, the Sanriku coast, where, you know, where the tsunami struck, that area is just, I mean, just a beautiful place. And if anything, they need the financial, you know, any financial support, especially from tourism, to help rebuild it still. And it is just an absolutely natural beauty. All the little coves along that coast has, you know, different little towns there, and they each have their own kind of unique kind of feel. And you could just go up and down there. It'd probably take you, I don't know, maybe about 4 or 5 days, but it's just a beautiful area of the country. That's one spot. The other one is, I definitely would, well, I guess a lot of people already go up to Hokkaido. Maybe I would say Aso, Mount Aso, which is in Kyushu. It's a big volcano. A lot of hot springs down there, really a rural area, very quiet, beautiful nature. I think it's the only volcano or one of the only volcanoes in the world that you can actually go right to the edge and look down in, active volcanoes. So that's amazing.
Wow.
That area there. And I'm trying to think where else. And I would say Wakayama too. Yeah, going down. The Kumano Kodo is another famous pilgrimage route through Wakayama. You can hike through there. But going along that coast around Wakayama is another famous area. There's a famous place there called Nachi, the Nachi Falls. Usually you see this photo of a pagoda with the falls behind it. That's called, it's Nachi. And that whole coast is another area that you can explore. I don't know, you could take a week or a couple of weeks hanging out just there and hiking through the forest there right across the whole prefecture. So that's definitely another spot to check out.
And you kind of held back on Hokkaido. You went for these other places. So, you know, what are your thoughts on, you know, Hokkaido? I mean, I hear I've not been myself, but I hear it's like the best place to eat food in Japan.
Yeah, it is. It is. But I think, you know, there is a lot of tourism up there. There are direct flights from overseas that do go there. We know a lot of the Australians, right? They ski up there. I know there's flights from Thailand and other countries, Southeast Asia, that will go right up there. So there are quite a few tourists, maybe closer to the west side. So maybe the east side of Hokkaido would be a good spot to go. Kushiro is on the east there. That is a beautiful area. There's a lot of beautiful nature and wildlife on that side. Wildlife sanctuaries. That's a good spot. So I shouldn't rule out Hokkaido, but maybe the east of Hokkaido is a little bit more free from the tourism.
And then, you know, on a final note, you visited Mount Fuji this year. Was that the first time? Was that the first time you went?
The other time I went was over 20 years ago when I just came visiting here. I was at the base, and then this was my second time down. But this was a different area. I was on the other side of Fuji, Kawaguchi on the other side. The other time I was in Shizuoka. So it was my second time there, yeah.
And can that be a day trip from Osaka?
No. It took a bullet train to I think it was somewhere in Shizuoka, and then I took a bus another 2 hours. So it would be, you could do it in a weekend, like maybe 2 or 3 days, but probably not a day trip, no.
And you started out like where most people do at Station 5, is that right?
Yeah, that was as far as like, and I was there in February, so that's the closest you can get to the top of the mountain.
Yeah, you can't. It's just not climbing season that time of year. Too dangerous.
No. Right, yeah.
Well, Dave, thank you so much. It's always great talking to you, and I love hearing your stories about, well, wherever you travel, but this time around, you know, just talking about Japan and your passion for all these different areas and, you know, finding out, you know, what life has been like the last year for you has been really great catching up. And as I said before, you're, you know, among many things, you're a prolific live streamer and you're always sharing stuff on Twitter. How can people find you or follow you?
I'm on Twitter, Dave in Osaka on Twitter, on YouTube, Twitch, Facebook. You can find me at Dave in Osaka there. And also on Instagram too, Dave in Osaka, those places. So
that's awesome. Dave, thanks so much.
Thank you, John. Take care.
Hey, thanks so much for listening and supporting the Far East Travels podcast. I want to give a shout out to Scott in Melbourne, who has been listening to the podcast, especially during the lockdown there. But I understand that you've now got that lifted, I think. So congratulations to you and everybody else who has been undergoing all kinds of levels of lockdowns everywhere and who's been listening to the Far East Travels podcast. Thanks so much. You can follow me on a few different places. Facebook, of course, Far East Travels podcast page. The Far East Travels page, John Sabo Official, or on Instagram, John Sabo's Far East Travels, Twitter, Far East _ Travels, and of course, the YouTube channel, John Sabo. So thanks again, and please be safe out there. And when we all start traveling again, and I know it won't be too long, I wish you safe travels, namaste, tashi delay, and peace.